This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Today's podcast is sponsored by FastBitcoins.com. Fast Bitcoins provides a simple way for people to buy Bitcoin directly from their bank account or with cash in physical stores. Their services are rapidly growing in availability across the UK, Estonia, as well as Canada, and they're launching in Australia soon too. Fast Bitcoins is committed to providing high-quality Bitcoin-only services. They want to make sure that the growing number of people interested in buying and benefiting from the possibilities of Bitcoin can do so easily, securely, and with as few distractions as possible. Learn more about Fast Bitcoin's range of services at fastbitcoins.com, including how you can earn Bitcoin for free through their referral scheme. That is fastbitcoins.com. Fastbitcoins.com. Go check them out.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram. Stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain, click and I bang.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, we have got on an Australian-British journalist and author of several fiction books. This is Helen Dale. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Zuby. How are you?
I am blessed and highly favored, as always. I'm very well. How are you?
How are you enjoying lockdown? How do you exercise? I mean, you're a fitness instructor. How do you even manage to do your job?
I actually just came back from a run and just had a super quick shower before jumping on this podcast. So I just started running this week. I actually hate running. I despise running. So that's why I'm trying to grow to not hate it. I'm very much in the bodybuilding, powerlifting, very object.
Yes, that's what I've always thought. Do you
that's what
like
I do.
Skipping? I mean, that might be a good alternative. People who box often skip.
I do a little. Like, I'll be honest, I normally do the sort of minimum cardio that I can get away with. So I do some because I don't want my heart health to be really bad or to not be able to do my training sessions, but I much more enjoy strength training. So I am still doing that. I've got a pull-up bar at home. I've been doing lots of bodyweight exercises, but I can't lie. This is in 16 years, this is the longest I've gone without going to the gym. So it is painful.
That's extraordinary. Yes. I mean, I did think of you when they locked because I think they shut the gyms down before they shut all the restaurants and everything down. And you were the first person I thought of.
Thank you.
Oh my goodness. How did he do his job?
I appreciate that, Helen.
So I couldn't think of anything worse.
Oh, as in having the stuff shut down or?
Yeah, just having your entire career and life just whipped out from underneath your feet like that.
Yeah, it's okay. I can still do everything else. I'm still in shape. No one would look at me and say, oh gosh, Zuby's let himself go. So I'm hanging in there.
That's good. I'm very pleased to hear. Because this whole lockdown thing is very, very peculiar. And I mean, I don't mind saying this because of the nature of your audience, but I'm going to confess it here. I have been very careful on social media, at Twitter and Facebook and even in my journalism, because I'm published a lot in sort of big outlets across the UK, to not describe my home circumstances, because I found it very confronting, the ways people who, like me, who have my sort of background, have a nice house and the home counties, the garden, lots of birds and sun and all of this, telling people in London in tiny flats that they have to stay in and they're not allowed to go and lie in Queen's Park in the sun.
Yeah.
And I just think, have you not paused to consider how you look? You're very entitled.
Yeah.
You know, and I just won't say it because, I mean, it's not hard to find out where people, journalists in particular with bylines all over the place.
Yeah.
It's not hard to find out where they live and what they do in their spare time.
Yeah, when you're seeing celebrities standing outside in their multi-million dollar or multi-million pound houses talking about how they feel like they're in prison and how they're suffering. It's a little bit tone deaf.
This is just so, don't go there. This is really bad. Have you not paused to consider how you look?
Yeah. Helen, can you bring the mic a bit closer to you?
Oh, sorry. Or yes. This is all very new to me. I'm apologies to Zuby's listeners who are used to him being extremely professional and exceptionally good. I'm completely rubbish at this. And if you've ever seen me on the BBC, which is why I don't do it very often because I'm terrible, I will do things like not speak into the microphone or fail to look at the camera or do something ridiculous like flick my hair all the way through the interview. And I'm sure it drives them all. Which is why I work on the principle that I'm much better in print than I am anywhere else.
That's all good. Practice makes perfect. So, Helen, I've done a really brief intro about you there, but why don't you tell the listeners who may not be familiar with you or your work a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Okay, fair enough. Well, the first thing, I've been on trigonometry before, but mainly talking because I'd done a big feature on Australian politics about the Australian election, and they got me to do commentary on that because the Australian political system is so distinctive. So I'll give you and your listeners a bit of background on this because I've got sort of two careers, and one of them is in one country and one of them is in the other.
Mm-hmm.
Over here, if you've read stuff of mine, you'll have seen it in The Spectator or CapEx or The Critic or Standpoint or journalism of the magazine sort. Now, I didn't start as a journalist. I became a journalist by accident and very much of accident. And it's actually only been full time since the middle of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
For a long period before then, I was a lawyer. I was in practice and I've been in different areas of the law and in both arms of the profession. I started out as a barrister, which are the ones that wear the wigs and the gowns and sort of dress like somebody from the 18th century, which is true. It's the dress of a sort of upper middle class person from the 18th century. And so I did that at first. And then I moved to the other arm of the profession, which is to be a solicitor. And I've worked as a corporate solicitor and what is described as a government solicitor in Australia, but isn't really, because the parliamentarian I was a legal advisor to was not actually in the government. He was what's known as a crossbencher, which is someone who isn't in either of the major political parties.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, before I became a lawyer and went into legal practice, I initially became known in Australia as a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And this book, I'll hold it up for you.
For those just listening.
Easily off from Waterstones or Amazon or Blackwell's or whatever. That's the new edition that came out. It was a 20th anniversary edition that came out a few years ago, but it's easily available now.
Mm-hmm.
If you see one with a red and blue cover, if you buy it, I won't get anything for it because that's one of the old editions, but it's quite likely to be valuable, particularly if it's signed, because it was sort of a whole lot of history with my first book.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that won a big award when I was only 22, which was quite
This book is, for people who are not watching, this book is called The Hand That Signed the Paper. And you originally published this under a pen name, which I can see is still sort of in the background on the cover.
On the cover, yes. Yeah. They put the publisher, when they did the anniversary edition, the publisher sort of went to town with the design. It's very pretty design, very cleverly done design, and put pen names in the background.
Yeah.
Now, this, as it explains on here, won multiple literary awards in Australia, and they put two of them on there.
Mm-hmm.
The one that is really well known is the Miles Franklin Award, which is the Australian equivalent of the Booker Prize or the Pulitzer Prize. Yeah, sort of the peak national literary award.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the youngest ever winner of it. Now, obviously,
congrats.
This is for a novel, not journalism. You know, I was a writer of novels. But one of the things that novelists can do fairly well is write what is known as colour writing, because you've got the skill to be descriptive and do travel writing and writing about the turf, actually, that kind of thing. So very, very slowly, and it was very gradual because I was a lawyer and I needed to do my job, and law is quite a demanding profession, long hours and that kind of thing. Very gradually, I would start to write some other things, mainly in Australia for a newspaper called The Australian, which is the sister paper to The Times over here and to The Wall Street Journal in the United States. And they share copy. So occasionally people will say to me, oh, I saw a piece of yours in The Wall Street Journal. And I go, when? And it's purely because they've taken a piece from one of the others. That happens quite a lot, but because they share each other's copy, basically. And they do pay very well, which is why I've always enjoyed writing for those papers. And what happened was I moved over to the UK. I've always moved back and forth ever since I was a child. My parents are both British, and I'm a true dual national in that I'm a home student in both jurisdictions, Australia and the UK, which is very unusual. Normally you have to pay international fees in one country or another, and I don't. That's very unusual. Lawyers will sometimes use the expression true dual. You know, I'm a true dual national. You know, I have NHS and Medicare cover of my own in the two different countries and all of that. So I became known in Australia as a novelist, and then got a little bit of, never very insistently, a little bit of colour writing, a bit of reviewing, you know, that kind of thing in Australia. Then I came over here and started to do journalism. Now, at first, it was similar to what I'd done in Australia. So it was kind of colour writing and book reviewing and that kind of thing. And you've probably seen a lot of my stuff in Quillette, and overwhelmingly it's cultural commentary and book reviews. But because I unusually have legal qualifications in both English law and Scots law, I did my English law at Oxford, where I was at Brasenose, which is a very strong law college. And I did my Scots law at the University of Edinburgh. It's one of the two sort of leading law universities. The other is Glasgow, and it's got a different legal system. Scotland has its Roman law. And so relatively unusually, I had this sort of unusual combination of qualifications. So people started to approach me to write about Brexit. And so for about 3 years, gradually building in intensity until last year, where it nearly drove me mad, I became a Brexit organ grinder and the organ grinder's monkey. And I just wrote about nothing but Brexit for multiple newspapers, multiple trade magazines. There's I write for a trade magazine in the US called Law and Liberty, which only publishes lawyers. And it was literally, here is a British lawyer explaining what the hell is going on in the UK for Americans, basically. And so that was all I did. And my last really big piece on Brexit actually was published on the 30th of December, 2019.
Okay.
So in Britain, I'm this person who bangs on about Brexit. In Australia, I'm this person who writes novels. And the irony is I was in the UK banging on about Brexit. And then in 2 years, in 2017 and then in 2018, I had two novels come out, one after the other. This is the one from 2017.
This is Kingdom of the Wicked,
Book One. And then in 2018 is the sequel, which is Book Two. And of course, because I have this established reputation as a novelist in Australia, I had to go back to Australia to do author tours to support them. And I'm quite pleased with these books because they managed to get noticed over here. And, you know, I had people like Tim Harford saying, oh, this is really clever and well done. I like these. And so I finished up with this British audience who found me through journalism, whereas my Australian audience, they see an article by me in the newspaper and they, oh, that's that novelist sounding off in the newspaper again. Now, what I will do, because I am no good at this, but my publisher is splendid, is I'm going to read the blurb on the back of Book One.
Okay,
because I think some of your listeners might be interested.
Okay, please do.
784 Ab Urbe Condita, 31 AD. Jerusalem sits uneasily in a Roman Empire that has seen an industrial revolution and now has cable news and flying machines, and rites and morals that are strange and repellent to the native people of Judea. A charismatic young leader is arrested after a riot in the temple. He seems to be a man of peace, but among his followers are zealots and dagger men sworn to drive the Romans from the Holy Land. As the city spirals into violence, the stage is set for a legal case that will shape the future, the trial of Yeshua ben Yusuf. Intricately imagined and ferociously executed, Kingdom of the Wicked is a stunning alternative history and a story for our time.
Ooh, so it makes me want to read it.
Yes, basically I rewrote the gospel stories.
Okay.
But I did the speculative fiction thing, the Neal Stephenson and Philip K. Dick, like The Man in the High Castle, and rewrote it as if the outcome had if things had happened differently, but I kept the same cast of characters.
Gotcha.
And I think this is the problem with novelists. I think Kingdom of the Wicked is really good. Mm-hmm. And each, if you add the two volumes together, it's probably sold about 20,000 copies, which sounds good. It sounds terrific. But this book, which won all the awards, mm-hmm. Has probably sold 140,000 copies. And I don't think it's as good.
Well,
but the thing is,
that's what
novelist
happens.
Doesn't get to tell the reading public.
No, it's like musicians. How many musicians of any genre do people think that their first album is their best? It doesn't matter.
Yes.
You know, 20 years later, they drop another. 10 years later, 30 years later, people still are like, oh, no, that one from 1995 is that was
and
the best
one. And I swear,
one.
I mean, you've how many albums have you put out?
8 albums and EPs.
Yeah. Okay. And you obviously have views about which one or ones you think are better.
Yeah, I generally think I get better over time.
Yes.
Especially with me, it's less with albums, more with individual songs. So there will be individual songs on my first or second album that people are like, oh yeah, that one is still your best song. You know,
Goonie Flow.
Oh, is that a...
That's my favorite of yours.
That's your favorite? Oh, thank you. Thank you.
It's very good. It's
oh,
very,
thank you so much.
I mean, I've got some choral background, so singing with yourself like that is very hard to do well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I do get people asking me who that is on the chorus, and I'm like, oh, that's
no,
me.
No,
that's,
I recognized it as you, but I thought, oh, this is very clever. He knows what he's doing.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate it. So actually, I'm really curious about the... So you've kind of got this dualistic... sort of not life, but career, and not just between two different types of writing and sort of two different art forms, shall we say, but also two different countries, and the split is sort of aligned with them. So I guess first question I have is, which do you enjoy more, or what are the sort of
this
is fulfilling
is a really
about
good
each one?
Question.
Yeah.
You know, for your next job, you get a job on Newsnight. I'm going to put the person on the spot. When I'm doing it, I love writing fiction. The feeling of being in that flow of writing fiction is extraordinary. Mm. It's like you just go off to this special place and do this amazing thing, and it's like coming back down to earth.
Yeah.
So that feeling of writing fiction is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Getting into that point is very difficult.
Yes.
Journalism, I don't enjoy as much writing at it, right? Actually, the physical experience of writing journalism.
Yeah.
There were times, for example, when I was writing about Brexit, that I just got absolutely sick of people getting fundamental, basic legal principles. And it was both sides were doing this, Leave and Remain. Mm-hmm. You know, and they were trying to do it to sort of serve their own arguments and serve their own interests. And it was not attractive. It did not look good. And it really started to make me quite cranky. And so I thought, oh, I'm being given a perch in all these various publications just to be accurate. And so I became obsessed with accurately stating the law and trying to go through clearly and carefully with readers, particularly when I was writing for Australians or Americans, and get across exactly what was going on, because it made me angry to see people making so many errors.
Sure.
And this was something I knew about. You know, I had a lot of expert knowledge, practitioner experience and expert knowledge and training and so on and so forth. This may not mean much to a lot of people, but some of your listeners will know. My tutor for constitutional law was Vernon Bogdanor, Professor Vernon Bogdanor.
I don't know who that is, so.
No, well, his main claim to fame was that he was also David Cameron's tutor at Brasenose, because Cameron went to the same college. In constitutional law, but Cameron did PPE and I did law. And the
arguments... PPE has a different meaning now.
Yes, I know. Sorry, for the Americans. Yeah. PPE is politics, philosophy and economics.
Yeah,
it's a degree at the University of Oxford.
Yeah.
And is enormously controversial, because there is an argument to be had that the... and I think it's a legitimate one, that it's too shallow because you only spend a year out of your 3 years on each of those areas. Mm-hmm. You can do it so you only do two, but most people do three, all three. And you can't learn very much in a year. I mean, you can't do a law degree in a year. You'll finish up coming out at the end and being useless to any law firm that hires you. So there's quite a lot of controversy over the PPE qualification. Very clever young people do it. You have to be clever to get into Oxford. Both you and I went through that experience. You know exactly what I mean. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of wasted. Their very high intellect is wasted on this qualification that's really quite shallow. So there's quite a lot of controversy about PPE. But anyway, the logic and the underlying reasoning that David Cameron fed into both his ultimate position on Brexit, where he fought the Remain camp on the Remain side, mm-hmm. but also why he had to hold a referendum, was very much from Vernon Bogdanort. So okay. people knew this and thought
and,
that
and
I
what,
could
And
kind...
what was that specifically? What was the reason that he
okay,
had to
okay,
do that?
Okay, the the legal rationale, and this is sort of the basis of constitutional, sort of English constitutionalism, is the way authority and power is exercised in a Westminster system. So basically, the people of the United Kingdom, when they vote, elect representatives who then reflect the power back to them, the power conferred on them by the people. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not like the United States. In Britain, the system is constructed. So those people who are given that power from the people are then not allowed to give away that power to a third entity mm-hmm. without the people's consent. And the Maastricht Treaty, what the Maastricht Treaty did was that in certain crucial areas, and I'll only name two, immigration and trade policy, power that was conferred on the representatives in Westminster by the people was given away to the European Union without a referendum.
Okay.
Now, in 1993, Vernon Bogdanort told John Major, said, you must put this to a referendum. You are going to create a constitutional crisis, if not now, in the future. And unfortunately, because at the time, and this reflects poorly on the Tories, at the time, because Vernon Bogdanort was a Lib Dem and Major was obviously a Conservative Prime Minister, Bogdanort's advice was ignored. Now, you might think someone's making a Brexity argument despite being a Lib Dem. Mm-hmm. The Lib Dems, when Bogdanort was involved with them, are not like this mad bunch of loonies who announce their pronouns now and try to celebrate Ramadan by eating bacon. I saw that. Oh, my God. That man tweeting out a picture of Ramadan. Oh, I'm breaking the fast at Ramadan.
Are you serious?
Lib Dem councillor.
No way. No way.
And he had this bacon on his plate.
Oh, how did I miss that?
And all
That's
these
amazing.
Jewish and Muslim people I know who follow me on Twitter or something, they were all going, one bit that all Jews and Muslims follow, even
oh,
if
no.
they don't follow any of the rest of their respective religions, is the oh, no bacon.
Yeah, that's a pretty basic. Oh, no.
It was very funny.
Was this on Twitter?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
And he got, I mean, the absolute idiot. And then he said, I have to eat this sort of food because I'm allergic. I have allergies. And I just thought, oh, dear Lord.
Oh, no. No.
Talk,
no.
You know, when you're in a hole, stop digging.
Yeah.
And
I'm curious. I'm sorry. I'm actually curious about this. Was he just trying to sort of show some sort of like solidarity with the
yes,
community?
Yes, that's
oh, okay.
What it was.
Okay.
Yes, they were sort of going out in sympathy and then not even bothering to like read the first page of the Quran, basically. You know, look up Islam on Wikipedia and find out basic principles of
That's
religion.
Funny. That is funny.
It was just sort of, it was really quite, but they didn't used to be like that. The Lib Dems used to be an interesting political grouping, and they were the heir to the Gladstonian tradition of liberalism in Britain, which is kind of gone now, which is a terrible shame. I mean, Stephen Davies, wonderful scholar at the University of Manchester, often says, if the Lib Dems want to be relevant again, they need to just go back to being the Liberal Party and stop being mad. And I think he's absolutely right. And so they didn't used to be like that. And so Vernon Bogdanort gave this advice to John Major. It was ignored. As you know, as most people know, Major made Maastricht a confidence issue because it was before the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. And that meant that it was passed. And what happened?
I'm learning a lot of politics right now, by the way.
Yeah, what happened?
People view me in this political lens, and I'm like, I know nothing about British politics.
This stored up an immense. It head of steam, I suppose, a head of constitutional steam was stored up over the course of 20-odd years.
Okay.
And it culminated, and David Cameron, because he'd been taught by Vernon, I was taught exactly the same thing. When David Cameron was saying, you know, we're going to have a referendum on this if the Conservatives win a majority, a lot of people get stuck into David Cameron, and he could be a bit twee, and he was a bad PM and pigs and all of the other jokes that are made about David Cameron.
Sure.
But his arguments for holding a referendum if the Conservatives won a majority at the 2015 GE, which they did, are actually very sound and constitutionally accurate. And a lot of people, not all, I mean, the sensible people are aware, lawyers from both Leave and Remain, are aware that this was a very large issue and it should have been dealt with one way or the other before Maastricht was signed.
Okay.
And it wasn't. And we finished up with a much worse problem because it wasn't dealt with in 1993 when Vernon Bogdanov said it should have been dealt with. That was when the referendum should have happened.
Okay.
And what would have happened then is it's quite likely that the British people would have rejected the handing over of those powers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's been a persistent undercurrent of British politics.
Okay, that's interesting.
For a long time. But they didn't want to, in 1993, leave the European Union.
Sure.
So what you would have finished up with is Britain gradually heading towards something like the EEA, like the Norwegians or the Swiss or that kind of thing. And it all would have happened very naturally and organically. And there would have been none of this dreadful division. And the UK would still be a member of the EU, but would have much more significant carve-outs. It would just be a free trade club, which was why my Margaret Thatcher wanted to join
the big free trade club. So sorry to interrupt you. So if I'm getting this clear, so a lot of people, the sort of popular narrative is that David Cameron sort of caved to people like Nigel Farage and people who are pushing for Brexit. And that was the only reason he had this referendum, because he kind of like caved. So what I'm understanding is that that's not really the fundamental case here. It's more that this
is something
that
was... It's not the constitutional case, no. Okay. Politically, it may well be.
Okay.
I wouldn't say to Nigel Farage so much. That's not true. But to forces within the Conservative Party.
Gotcha.
The Tories have spent, since Thatcher, basically, fighting internally, banging on about Europe, David Cameron used to call it, you know, this constant banging on about Europe. And a lot of people, you know, if you've paid any attention to British political Twitter, were very shocked when Keir Starmer came out and agreed with Boris Johnson saying, no, I don't want a Brexit extension. And they don't understand why he's doing that. Because now the torch, the pro-Europe torch, has gone from the Tory party. The Tories have done one of their periodic national reinventions of themselves and become the party of Leave and the party of economically responsible Remain. That was the logic
of,
as well.
The party of the NHS.
But the reason Keir Starmer is doing what he is doing when it comes to the Europe issue is Labour is now in the position, if it's not very careful, where it will spend the next 20 years banging on about Europe. And anybody with the faintest knowledge of British politics and history is aware of the extent to which the Tories inflicted terrifying instability on themselves, kept losing leaders, even prime ministers, because the party kept internally banging on about Europe. And what Cameron thought he would achieve with the referendum, apart from the constitutional arguments in the back of his head that came from his tutor at Oxford. But he also thought that this would fix it. But the reason he thought it would fix it was because he thought Remain would win. And of course,
I'm aware of that part.
Yeah, and of course, that all turned to complete, blew up everywhere, all over everyone.
Yeah.
And so there we are.
Gotcha.
But yes, constitutionally, the reason is you can't delegate powers given to you by the people without people's consent.
That's interesting. That's like a sort of important detail that I don't think many people sort of latch onto. I mean, it's weird. It's funny how in this time period we're in now, how quickly Brexit has kind of become a not a thing. I feel like in the US, everyone was, if you think of the beginning of the year, in the UK, it was all Brexit, Brexit, Brexit. US, it was all impeachment, impeachment. And so quickly, I've heard very little about like that. It's just like, that's just gone. Something else happened. And it's just everyone's attention and outrage and emotions have totally gone elsewhere.
Everything has become coronavirus. And that's why you've had this in a lot of countries, you've had this extraordinary, what's known amongst political scientists and pollsters as a rally effect, which is where it doesn't matter who's in power and whether they've got two heads and green teeth, They've become enormously popular. So Donald Trump's had a rally effect in the US. Jacinda Ardern, who's a very different politician, has had a rally effect in New Zealand. Scott Morrison's had a rally effect in Australia. Boris Johnson's had a rally effect here, mm-hmm. you know, where he's just impervious. They're just impervious because they seem to be almost leading a government of national unity.
Yeah.
Although that added to that is that the leaders of the opposition in both the UK and Australia are competent.
Yes.
You know, Keir Starmer's just nothing like Jeremy Corbyn. He's just a normal person. It's nice to see. And in Australia, Anthony Albanese is also, is a normal person. He's competent. He's kind. You know, he's not a fool.
Yeah.
I struggle to understand American politics. I think they're completely mad.
I mean, I understand American politics.
The system with a nice, stable leader of the opposition.
Yeah, it's funny. I probably know more about American politics than I do British.
Yes, well, I mean, I know a little bit, but a little knowledge is dangerous, so I keep my mouth closed mostly.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, I mean, so coming back to the sort of earlier question, I mean, so I think that. Because I'm asking this as someone who also does more than two things, but I do a lot of different things, which I feel use quite different, very different parts of my brain, right? If I'm recording a podcast like this, or I'm doing some kind of social commentary or something, that's very much one thing. But if I'm creating a song, I'm just coming up with an idea in my head and turning it into musical form. That's like a very different thing. And they both satisfy different parts of my brain. So I sort of imagine with you, that's kind of similar. Cause that, you know, when you're talking about politics and Brexit and legal stuff, that's very much one thing. But then it's like, you also are writing these incredibly creative novels and coming up with.
Yes, it is. It's a completely different part of my head.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. And how do you, what's your kind of process for that? Because I am curious as a creative person. I get people all the time who are like, how do you even write a song? How do you come up with it? And it can be tricky to explain, but I think with a novel specifically, I always think this with novels and with films because of the length, right? Because of the length of them, I'm kind of like, how do you even think of this? So you were talking about your book, The Kingdom of the Wicked. So what's your process for coming up with the idea? And thinking, oh yeah, that's all right. I can understand how you think of an idea for a nonfiction book, right? Okay, I want to write a book about fitness. It's very clear. I don't need to be super creative, but in that case, it's like
I know this stuff. I have this experience.
Exactly.
I have these skills.
Exactly.
So, I think I can share those ideas skillfully to others.
Yes.
I know a lot about personal training. Da da da. Yes, I can imagine how you. Yes.
Yeah. So it's harder for me to conceive. Whoa. Okay. Where did this idea come from? And then. How do you materialize it? Did you sort of think of the whole majority of the concept and then you fill in the details, or do you do it somewhat as you go along? What's your process for that? I'm curious.
I'm a fairly high level conceptual thinker. When I come to writing fiction, and I've got three novels now and I've got a fourth one on the go, I come up with a concept first that's very, very theoretical.
Mm.
To give you an idea, the book I'm working on now, and you can see where it comes from. And I don't have a title for it yet, but I can give you a one sentence elevator pitch, basically, is what would have happened if the UK had voted to leave in 1975, which was the last time there was a Brexit referendum. And at the time, they voted to remain.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's speculative fiction. It's like Kingdom of the Wicked. It has that same quality. And it also involves me thinking of alternative paths that history could take. Now, I've had to move the furniture. And the most obvious moving of the furniture that I've done is John Smith doesn't die. So there is no Tony Blair. Blair doesn't become leader of the Labour Party because John Smith becomes Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can hear the sort of high-level political journalist talking when I frame that. But when it comes to people written, it will be written as a novel overwhelmingly about ordinary people, mm-hmm. and all the politics and all the speculative fiction and all the science will very much be in the background. But I have to build that world in my own head by doing extensive research and writing that never sees the light of day, although it might in the form of an essay.
Mm-hmm.
There is an essay at the end of this book that was also published by the Cato Institute, so you can read it without buying the book, that is essentially documents my thinking, process of thinking that I went through when I came up with Kingdom of the Wicked. Mm-hmm. So I come up with the very high level framework and do a lot of research for it.
Yeah.
And as a process of the research, I then start to think of ideas of real people, and I start to populate the framework with characters. Mm-hmm. And I build the characters up in incredible detail. Now, have you ever played Dungeons and Dragons?
I have not. I'm somewhat familiar with it. I know people in my boarding school and stuff used
to. Well, you will know, those of you who played D&D, and I'm so old, I've never played the game version. I've only ever played the ones with the dice and mm-hmm. the Dungeon Master and the board game.
Yeah.
But you will know that there's a character matrix that you use in Dungeons and Dragons. Now, when I build my characters for all of my novels, I use the Dungeons and Dragons character matrix.
Okay.
So chaotic neutral, chaotic good, you know, ordered evil, chaotic evil, that kind of thing. And I have the character matrix in front of, sort of pinned, usually pinned up on the wall. Mm-hmm. And I gradually, as I'm working on my character profiles, I gradually, each box gets a name or a couple of names. And once I've worked out my characters and what sort of orientation they have, I then do the Dungeon Master thing. You come across a crudely drawn map. So I then put them in situations the way a dungeon master would in Dungeons and Dragons.
Okay.
And build the story out of that. Now, if you read my novels and, you know, you've got, oh, goodness, nearly 500,000 words there mm-hmm. to get through, you will not notice any of this.
Yes.
You will not notice any of the background that goes into it.
Yeah.
But that's how I do it. Okay. And I've done it 3 times now, and I'm in the process of doing it for my what I call my Brexit book. So it will follow the same pattern.
That's interesting.
Now, that is completely different from journalism.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
I mean, it is like I grow an extra eye to write fiction.
Yeah, well, because one of them, like I said, one is based in fact. So if something is about fact or knowledge or even opinion, that's really different to creativity, right? For example, there are podcasts which are like almost storytelling podcasts where it's like a book, but it's in podcast form. And I have no idea where I would even begin to craft that kind of thing, because I'm creative in one sense, but in that sort of sense, if I really tried over a long period of time, I could do it. I mean, I have written short stories and stuff when I was in school, but it wasn't something that sort of came naturally to me like other things do. So I am really, and I speak to more, most authors I know have written nonfiction books. I don't know many novelists. I know a lot of people who have written books. I've got some of them on my bookshelf, but they're all nonfiction. So, well, majority anyway. So yeah, it does really intrigue me of that process.
I was supposed to have a nonfiction book come out this year, but of course it's been delayed because of coronavirus.
Okay.
And it was literally going to be a linked collection of my pieces on Brexit. Mm. I don't know whether it's going to, I mean, I wrote so much, I worked out, I started to keep a running total, and I think I've written about 100,000 words on Brexit.
Wow.
Which is a 400-page book.
Yeah.
What makes, and I mean, so, and some of it's a bit repetitive. I'd have to go through and cut this article out because I think it makes a similar point or the same point as that article, whatnot. But I'm reasonably confident that I could still produce a 300-page book on Brexit.
On Brexit, yeah.
And everything in there would be new and original, you know, as what each makes you, would be different.
What makes you so passionate about Brexit? I notice when it comes to Brexit, I'm very dispassionate about Brexit. But some people are super duper passionate about it. What is it that drives that passion?
People have very strong views about the substantive content of national identity. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have very strong views, particularly in this country, in part because in many respects, England in particular, but also Scotland, were among the first true nation states mm-hmm. in the modern sense. You know, high state capacity, uniform systems of law, excellent education systems, albeit only for people at the top of society, but every civilization was like that.
Sure.
A capacity for self-criticism, as in, oh, we did this wrongly. We need to fix it. Mm-hmm. This is very, very unusual in the larger context of human history. You just don't see it very often. Civilizations have almost no capacity to, for example, I mean, I'm picking an ancient civilization here because my first degree was before I became a lawyer, was in classics. If you look at the speech of Cracticus, which is put in the mouth of a British chieftain by the Roman historian Tacitus, and it includes the very famous quotation, they make a desert and call it peace. So, I mean, imagine a Roman saying that about his own people. Now, the way he does that is by putting the words in the mouth of an enemy, but by giving Caractacus, the British chieftain, such a tremendous speech and portraying him as a real person, albeit an enemy, what Tacitus shows is this capacity for self-criticism of one's, even if one's own civilization is very, very great, you still have this ability to criticize it. It's very rare historically. Mm. It is something, for all that its historic greatness as a civilization, it is something that China struggles with. It's not just modern China with this inability to take criticism over coronavirus. It's a cultural weakness in Chinese civilization that is thousands of years old and it probably contributes. And I strongly recommend reading some of Steve Davies's work on this, the historian of the University of Manchester, as mentioned.
Okay.
It probably contributed to China being the country that almost, but not quite, had an industrial revolution. And the reason it didn't quite hit that bar that you have to hit to industrialize is because it lacked the ability to self-criticize. So there's something quite striking in the context of European history about England and Scotland.
Okay. And that's even if people don't specifically know the history, because most people won't, that's sort of in the culture and just in the people.
Okay. It's embedded in the psychology of the people.
Okay.
I mean, this is very, I mean, obviously it's quite widely known, and I'm happy to say it again. I'm a Tory. I'm a fairly traditional conservative in the British sense. So it's cultural conservatism rather than social conservatism. It's quite different in the two countries.
Sure.
But that very strong rooted sense of what a country and culture and people's specific way of approaching the world is sort of embedded in conservatism. Edmund Burke talked about conservatism being a contract between the generations, the generations that have gone, the generations that are with us, and the generations yet to be born.
Okay.
And so the reason Brexit on all sides, because there are remain ways of making this argument too, particularly in the context of the history of One Nation Toryism. People are deeply rooted in their culture and history and become extremely invested in it. And that is why the Brexit debate was so fraught.
Yeah.
Now, initially, I was like you. I was kind of superficially interested, but not terribly taken with it, and was still busily trying to write about Ascot and things like this. What the Colour Rider does. You know, when we eventually have Ascot again, publishers of the world, I would like tickets, please, so I can write about Ascot. You know, I couldn't go to Cheltenham, and it was the last festival, and all of this kind of, that kind of thing.
Poor you.
I was not terribly interested either.
Yeah.
And what got me interested was people making basic legal errors, you know, not understanding what progressive powers were. And I don't want to go into all of this. I've done one legal thing for you already, and it gets boring for people who aren't lawyers. But, I mean, making very basic and fundamental legal errors, and I spat off about it on Twitter or on Facebook, and because I'm loads and loads of my followers on Twitter and friends that I have are from either the Canberra Press Gallery or the Westminster Gallery or whatever. They, can you write about this? Do you have a law degree? Oh, your Vernon Bogdanor was your tutor, wasn't he? Da 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 da. And so that's how I got suckered into Brexit. And
I must say that guy has a great name. It sounds like a character.
It's great. I don't know what nationality it is.
Sounds like a Harry Potter character.
Polish or something.
Yeah, it's a great name. Every time you say it, I feel like you're talking about a fictional character.
Yeah, you sort of, you imagine him with a shield and one of those 10-foot swords. And, is this person an Oxford law professor? Yeah.
I now don't want to Google him because I don't want to see what he looks like because I have an image in my brain and I don't want to ruin it.
So that's how I got tangled up in it. And I got passionate about it because of people making errors, and it was schoolgirl errors, and it was very embarrassing. The irony is that because I then had developed this sort of reputation for banging on about Brexit, and one of the things I did do quite a lot of is I tried to take various economic models seriously and write about them in an intelligent way. And that was enough to show to people that I was also numerate. And so then I had people, and I had one newspaper, which shall remain nameless, attempt to get me to write a piece about Neil Ferguson's modelling for coronavirus.
Okay.
And I believe I sent them a link to the Oxford University Mathematics Department webpage and said, you might want to get a mathematician, not a lawyer, to write about this. And yes, I know the experts in pretty much everybody's country, they all came up with different policy ideas. Yeah. Lots of different countries have tried different strategies. It seems that the ones that were used in Taiwan and South Korea and Australia and New Zealand were the most successful, the track and test model, and also very, very rigorous quarantine, just shutting the borders.
Yeah.
But people didn't know that when those policies were introduced.
Yeah.
When there might have been a bit of a hint in places like Australia or Taiwan because they had to deal with SARS.
I'm finding that people don't really want to talk about places that have handled it well. Are you finding that's another thing?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's the availability heuristic that goes with the news. You know, people, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah.
So they want all the dreadful stories, you know, about New York and London. Although London's come good now, the whole irony is, or Northern Italy when it was in the toilet and that kind of thing. But the point I'm making, and you know, there's this sort of joke that's told amongst statisticians, and your prediction is difficult, especially about the future. and I was just sort of thinking, nobody knows what's going to work here because it's a novel virus.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the point. And so I very unusually for me, I rejected a commission because I just thought, no, you have to find someone. You don't want a jobbing lawyer who happens to have got an A in maths at A level.
Yeah.
you actually want to find one who used their A in maths at A level and then went off and did a maths degree rather than a law degree. And even there, you won't necessarily get it right. But
the thing is, no one's an expert. I'm stealing this quote from someone because I think someone just said it on Twitter. I don't think it was like a well-known person, but I was like, that's actually perfect. They said, it takes time to become an expert. And this thing is so new that nobody is an expert on it, which is the truth. People, you could have studied, even if you've studied virology or you've studied mathematics or you've studied, no one knows, right? Like even the experts. We've seen just how wrong, I mean, if you go back just to January or February or March, how wrong many of these models that everything has been based on have been shown to be, and how wildly inaccurate a lot of the predictions were. And it's like, well, even the experts, so-called experts, they might be an expert on, you could be an expert on one virus, but that doesn't mean that the next one that comes along is going to have the same patterns and the same growth rate and infection rate and you might be able to test for this one, but you can't test for this one. There might be a vaccine for this one, but not for that one.
There's really only two decisions that a number of countries made that I think you can legitimately criticize them for, whether it was based on expert knowledge or politicians being or a combination of the two.
Mm.
The first mistake that was made was not testing.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to matter quite a lot. You know, and the countries that tested a lot, even if they pursued otherwise different strategies, like Australia's strategy was very different from Taiwan's and that kind of thing, but both have had a successful outcome.
Yeah.
But both countries tested extensively. That seems to be an issue. And the other thing that has happened, and as a result of it, you've actually finished up with the absurd situation where developing countries have finished up doing better than developed countries.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I'm thinking of here is India. Is countries that discharge people into care homes.
Yes. I was going to say the entire continent of Africa has had like a couple thousand deaths, the entire continent out of over a billion.
One
people.
Thing, although I am concerned about the economic damage being done in a lot of African countries. I've got South African relatives, and I just don't think that's good for that country, what they're doing there.
Mm.
Terrible unemployment already.
What's the what are they doing there specifically? I'm not aware.
Very, very severe lockdowns. And they've also, and basically because of their heavy dependence on tourism and people can't even travel internally to do internal tourism. Basically, they're one really massive export industry that is known to be exceptionally good and they're very good at it. And they've got lots to see. I was in South Africa in January and February. It's an extraordinary country. The thing that they can use to get themselves out of an economic hole is being taken from them. And I think that's to the extent that various African countries, sunny countries, didn't discharge people into the elder, sick people into care homes.
Yeah.
India didn't discharge sick people into care homes.
Mm-hmm.
So you finished up with this incredible situation where a country like India has actually doing better than pretty much the whole of Western Europe, yeah. except Germany. Mm-hmm. And what did Germany do? Test and not discharge sick people into care homes.
Yeah, yeah.
So those do seem to be the two legitimate areas where every country that did that failed to test and was sloppy about where sick people finished up from hospitals and put them in care homes where they were less likely to be well cared for or yeah. more likely to spread the coronavirus.
Yeah.
Those seem to be two things you can legitimately criticise them for. But the thing is, they didn't have powers of prognostication. Nobody can see the future. You know, prediction is difficult,
no,
especially
course
about
not.
The future.
Of course not. And in, I don't know, I haven't been silent on the topic, but I've been fairly quiet on it just because it's become, like a lot of things do, it's just become such a mess of opinions and noise and people yelling at each other and creating weird false dichotomies of right now, you know, there's this whole, we've got two options. We can lock everything. We can kill the economy and people live, or we can open the economy and everyone dies. And if you want to open the economy, it's because you want grandma. It's almost become a meme at
you
this point, right?
You want
grandma. And it's just kind of like, guys, come.
It's
so weird. It's like talking to children. I'm just like, look, there's a sliding scale here. We're not talking about an on and off switch. We're talking about, you know, and there are legitimate concerns and questions of civil liberties, right? Like you've got people. There's places where people are being arrested for going to the park or for going to jog, right? There are legitimate questions here, right? You've got people wanting to download apps, or people are talking about microchipping people. And I'm kind of like, well, that's a whole other concern here now for something that
concern me, that anti-lockdown protests, and I know it was full of maddies, and people who think 5G causes coronavirus and all this bonkers conspiracy stuff, which I've written about. I've written about for The Critic, which is a British magazine, and I'm in the process of writing about for The Spectator, also British, but it'll come out in Australia as well. And the conspiracies are mad. I acknowledge that. But the whole point of civil liberties is that even cranks get them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite alarmed to see at that protest in Hyde Park where the cranks were out, and Piers Corbyn was there and he was being king of the cranks, and he's an even bigger crank than Jeremy Corbyn, which is quite difficult to do. And the problem is he's also a smart crank. The guy's an astrophysicist. He's very, very clever.
Mm-hmm.
He was out there, and I saw, and it never looks good, and I tweeted to this effect and had an enormous bin fire in my Twitter comments. But
join the party.
I saw one solitary black man set upon by five coppers,
mm-hmm.
white coppers,
mm-hmm.
who arrested him. And okay, yeah, black people commit crimes too, so whoop-de-doo. But in the process of arresting him, once they'd subdued him, one of the coppers knee-dropped him.
Oh.
And the man had already been subdued.
Yeah.
And I just sort of sat there and thought, I don't like this.
Yeah.
That's a fairly obvious and flagrant breach of fairly basic civil liberties.
Yeah.
And the too many members of Her Majesty's Constabulary are enjoying this far too much.
That's literally, you pretty much took the words out of my mouth. That's what I've said before. The police, certain, not all of them, not even most of them, but there are certain people, both in the police and also government officials, especially if you see what some of the governors and mayors are doing in the USA, for example, where it's going state by state.
I've heard it on the Bush Telegraph.
Some of them are enjoying this too much, right? They're essentially doing compliance tests, right? They're just saying very arbitrary things that aren't going to keep people safe, right? Things that aren't going to do whatever. For example, yesterday, I can't remember which state it was, but they're now allowing they're going to reopen restaurants and malls to, I think, 50% capacity, but all churches can only have 10 people in them at a time.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Right? How is that not obviously?
The other thing is, I have seen some quite silly complaints, and this is, I mean, and one of the things that just putting that tweet out with the video of the black man getting knee dropped, one of the things that I realised in my mentions as this enormous bin fire just developed was that there's the lockdown left.
Mm-hmm.
There are particular species of lefty who can work from home. They're upper middle class, and that the lockdown can go forever as far as they're concerned.
All
it's not going to damage their career or life or ability to educate their children or so on and so forth. But on a counterpoint, there's also the pro-police right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, despite the fact that there is a degree, although it's not perfect, correlation between Remain, lockdown left, and left of centre politics, leave, anti-lockdown or moderated lockdown and Brexit. Mm-hmm. There is a degree of correlation, but it's by no means perfect. What I found was I would have the lockdown left not knowing what to do with themselves because they think they're anti-racist, and he was a black man fairly transparently being treated very badly because of his skin colour. And so they didn't know what to do with themselves. And then I had my right-wing friends who really do object for quite good economic reasons to aspects of the lockdown, then trying to stick up for the five white coppers who are on this guy. Yeah. And I'm just going, trying to navigate between the lockdown left and the pro-police right with the coronavirus situation is just incredibly difficult. And I just finished by having to say, look, I'm a lawyer. I started at the criminal bar. I have, whilst I'm generally pro the police and I am aware of what happens when you have, for example, the police not prosecuting Pakistani Muslims with the grooming gangs and that kind of thing on the basis of political correctness. I recognise that that's wrong. This is also wrong. Me dropping a man in the middle of Hyde Park because he wants to, he disagrees with the lockdown. That's also wrong. You know, you need to be able to hold these two thoughts.
Yeah. And when that's a big problem with this sort of political tribalism, it's why I don't mind other people defining me politically or trying to people can label me what they like. Right. And I certainly have my leanings, but I don't label myself because I don't ever want to get caught in this thing of feeling like I need to defend something that is wrong because it's come from inverted commas, my side.
My or, team. Yes. Yes, we're trying not to reduce politics to football.
No, or I can't accept a good idea that comes from the other side. You see what I mean? And it's like, no, like I stand on my principle. I'm not really, I'm as cheesy as it may sound. I'm pro human. Right. So I don't need to narrow it down any more than that. I think that most people are decent, regardless of their race, their color, their gender, whatever, whether they're in the police or whatever. But there are bad apples in each group. And in fact, if you are pro-police, as far as I'm concerned, you need to call out when they do go wrong.
Yes. Right. Because people won't believe you.
Yes. Because if people don't do that, then you kind of become a hack, right? That's just being dishonest, because saying that police don't ever make mistakes and that's because it's, and with police, it's like extra important because police can kill people, right? But police have powers.
It's very simple.
Yeah. Police have powers that the average citizen does not. So if police make serious cock ups, then that has a lot more gravity than, I don't know, a school teacher making a cock up, because a school teacher is not going to kill someone, right? A police officer might shoot somebody, might injure someone as they're, you know, knee drop someone or arrest someone totally incorrectly or whatever. Like, we've seen the consequences of this many times. So as someone who is, I'm not one of these people trying to dismantle the police as an institution or something. That's silly.
And I think, and this is, once again, this is the sort of essence of the conservative contract between the generations. Institutions are only worth preserving if you continue to put into them. You can't just draw from them. You have to put into them. Mm-hmm. And that includes a sort of sensible process of ensuring that they stay fit for purpose.
Yes, exactly. And that they know they can't just get away with stuff. Because if people let those things slide, right? If the police knee drop someone here and then they tase someone there and they shoot someone there when they're not supposed to, and you keep defending them, then the police themselves over time realize and know, oh, we can actually get away with abusing our power. And I don't know. I think that's why, it's funny. I'm probably more of a, if someone's going to call me a conservative, I'm probably more of a Republican than a Tory.
This bizarre thing that you have an American accent. You don't have an American accent. You sort of have a TV accent, basically.
It's in the middle.
It's very plain, difficult to locate globally sort of accent. You use a few British expressions, but you don't sound to me like an American.
That's interesting.
You know, I see people constantly saying, oh, Zuby has an American accent. And I'm going, to me, he doesn't. I mean, he might use a few American expressions. And obviously, I know the custom in the music that you do is to use an American accent, but that's different. I mean, lots of musicians sound American and their mouth and they sound like they're from Essex.
Yeah. I mean, I went to an American school up until from the ages of 4 till 11. So, you know, I grew up in Saudi Arabia. I did go to an American school. So I used to sound 100% American, but then I came to the UK.
You go American, and that American, does sound American.
Yeah.
In the name.
I came to the UK and I went to boarding school from 11, and then I was in school here, but I was still, I only moved to the UK permanently in 2008. So I was back and forth between the two countries for a long period. So
Saudi Arabia or Nigeria as well?
I've never lived in Nigeria. So my family background is from Nigeria, but I moved to Saudi when I was one, and I lived in Saudi from age one up until 20. So I was in Saudi for almost 20 years.
But in an international school.
Yeah, international school, American school system. So I was in that school system up until fifth grade. And then after that, I came to the UK, went to boarding school here, and was back and forth between the two countries, between here and Saudi.
Yeah, so you finished up with this very, my father used to describe it as a Euro pudding accent, it's just a mixture of, you know, you say grade, which is very American, whereas British and Australian people say year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So
I code switch. This is the thing. So if
yes,
I'm
code switching.
I code switch, yeah. So if you hear me recording a podcast with an American, I will use different words for certain things than I will if I'm doing a podcast with a British person. And it's just automatic, just for clarity of understanding.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I have a Euro pudding accent. I mean, my father used to joke about it. And whereas he had this, I mean, he's from Scotland, but he was this sort of social class and background, they used to joke. There's a joke, and I'm sure it's still true. It certainly was when I was last living in Scotland, which was in 2014, that you get a certain sort of Scottish person who wants to be English. And the main way that they show this is by having a home counties accent. Okay. So my father spoke the Gaelic and could do a perfectly good Scots accent, sound completely Scottish amongst his Scottish friends if he wanted to. But whenever he spoke around the family or around anybody else, he had an RP.
That's funny.
Yeah, Boris Johnson accent, basically. You're very, quite posh. And it's just, and so, I've finished up with this as a result of going back and forth from the age of four between these two countries. I've got this very, very peculiar accent. Yeah. I go to Australia and they go, you sound weird. And then I come here and then they go, you sound weird.
Yeah.
The nature.
I love accents. I think accents are just I think accents are a very cool thing. I think it's like a, to me, it's like a, I don't know, like a fingerprint of where someone, of someone's history, right? Just from hearing someone's accent, you can, there's a story behind it, right? Like whether that's on a national, on a regional level. So within the UK, I love it. I mean, with my music, I travel around the UK and it's one of the coolest things that it's subtle but obvious is when you're in each different city or in each different town, just how differently
people, the regional variation.
It's amazing.
In the UK is extraordinary,
especially considering how small it is.
Yes, well, I mean, the US has this as well, but mm-hmm. it's over a much larger area. I mean, but you're never going to mistake a New York accent for an Arkansas accent.
No.
They really sound different.
Yeah.
Over a much larger area, whereas you can just go to the next village in this country and the accent is different. Yeah. You see that in Italy as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's irreducibly regional, and you get you get regional variations in the language that's used and the style of speech. They all speak standard Italian, but they often have dialect as well. And the dialects are ancient. They go back to antiquity. The Roman writers wrote about dialects.
Okay.
You know, there was Latin and then there were all dialects.
Yeah.
And they have fed into the sort of what underlies modern standard Italian. So a lot of countries have this.
Yeah, they do. No, they all do. I just think it's I don't know. I just like accents. I just think it's a cool thing because there's a story behind each one. You just hear someone speak and it's like, oh, there's a story there. Whenever someone hears me talk, especially if someone hears that I'm British and then they hear my voice, they're like, okay, there's something there. Like, I need to ask him about that. You know, there's...
I mean, you don't sound British either, but the thing is this idea that before I heard your voice and before I met you at that function, Jordan Peterson thing, I mean, I kept seeing this, oh, Zuby sounds American. And then you got up to speak and I'm going, some people need to get better ears. I mean, because if it's there, it's so soft. It's such a soft accent. Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you. Awesome, Helen. We're around the hour mark right now. So this is what, again, it's been awesome having you on the show. You're one of those people I feel like we could sit here and talk for
but
5 hours.
But we ought to stop for the benefit of your listeners.
It would never get boring.
You have best things to do.
But let people know where they can find you and check out your work online.
My Twitter handle is @_HelenDale. But there is an underscore first because obviously Helen Dale is an exceedingly commonplace name and there were lots of them on Twitter before me.
Okay. Helen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Zuby, and good luck with your ongoing career.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to seeing more from you.
Okay, it's coming. Thank you.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the grand, stunting you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.